Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't oh, yeah.
You know we're gonna have a
starting to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing, as usual, with Pete Seeger and David Burns, our Solartopia theme song here at the Green Power and Wellness Show on PRN FM. Thank you, crew in New York. We got a killer hour to deal with nuke power today. So much stuff has come up, and we are right in the middle of the hurricane barreling in to the east coast of the United States. Tim Judson, are you with us yet?
I am, Harvey.
Okay, Tim. Now, we're going to be joined by Linda Seeley. Linda, you with us? Linda, sounds like there's life there. Donna Gilmore in San Diego area.
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, and Paul Kangas in the Bay Area. Paul, you with us? All right, so Paul will check in and Linda will check in. We got mostly Californians on the show today, but Tim, I know you've got to go, but I do want to have you, from Nuclear Information Resource Service, I do want to have you tell us what's happening now with the hurricane and the nuclear plants. There's a large number of nukes that are in the path of this monster hurricane. What's the latest? Are we going to have six or seven Chernobyls coming up, or what's our status here?
Well, hopefully we won't have any Chernobyls coming up, but you know, this is you know, been a real concern for the last few days. You know, with you know, Hurricane Florence, you know, gaining in size and strength, and you know, and approaching the Carolinas, which really is a, you know, sort of a hotbed of nuclear power plants in the country. And, you know, and what's been a particular concern to a lot of people is that the storm is expected to make landfall right near Wilmington, North Carolina, on the, you know, on the sort of south southeastern edge of the state, which is where the Brunswick nuclear power plant is. Which, you know, consists of two reactors that are of the exact same size and, I mean, exact same design and vintage as the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi that that melted down in 2011.
Mm. Well, I'm terrified. How big of a storm surge will it take to seriously threaten the operation of these nukes?
Well, it's a little unclear. You know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Duke Energy, which is the utility there, claim that that they've made upgrades since Fukushima to protect the plant against storm surge and the kind of inundation that we're expecting. But you know, it's a little unclear. There's been some concerns about the lack of documentation on the upgrades that have been made since Fukushima. And just a general lack of information about exactly sort of what the status of the plant storm barriers and those sort of things are. You know, I mean, it's one of these situations where, you know, you've got to expect that, you know, that despite the huge level of distrust that the public rightly has in the NRC and in the industry, that they're not going to just leave us as a sitting duck for, you know, for a situation like this. You know, we're looking at a storm of, you know, epic proportions with, you know, up to a 13-foot storm surge. And, you know, when they're talking about waves of potentially up to 24 feet crashing on the shoreline as the storm hits. So, you know, it's really, you know, I think people are rightly concerned, and all we can do is hope for the best right now. I mean, one of the things that people have to remember is that even if they had shut down the reactors a couple of days ago in advance of the storm, You know, that doesn't mean that that all would be well if, in fact, the same kind of a flood hit the reactor site as, you know, as hit Fukushima. You know, when they shut a nuclear power plant down, the fuel inside the reactor, you know, remains extraordinarily hot and has to be cooled almost as much as when the reactor is operating for several days. So if the site loses power the way that the Fukushima site did, and the emergency backup power supplies like the diesel generators are knocked out, you could still end up in a catastrophic situation.
So these idiots really should have shut these reactors a week ago, at least.
We can always say that, and this is I think one of the things that can really drive you nuts about nuclear power is they could have shut down the reactors a week ago and there would be a lot less concern about this. But the reality is that when these storms happen, you don't know exactly where the storm's going to go. And so you don't know exactly which power plants really need to shut down.
Now, my understanding is that the storm is headed a little further south than they originally thought. And so some of the nukes are going to be off the hook and, some other words are going to be more endangered. Is that right?
If it's tracking a little further south than originally planned, I hate to speculate about it because, you know, the Brunswick reactors are actually about 30 miles south of Wilmington. So if it's tracking further south, it may be more of a direct hit on the plant. You know, it's hard to tell based on the information that we're getting. All we know is that the officials are well aware that this, you know, that the storm is going to be hitting, you know, right near this plant, and they've got to be prepared for it. Now that said, you know, there's 12 reactors total in South Carolina and North Carolina, and four more reactors in Virginia, you know, that are within the path of the storm. While Brunswick obviously is the first one of concern, the problem is that they're talking about, you know, even inland, you know, really epic amounts of rainfall that could be causing flooding, not just on the coast, but along rivers and at higher elevations. It's anybody's guess as to how this is really going to play out. There's always unexpected things that happen in these huge storms.
And plus the spent fuel pools. I mean, there's no protecting the spent fuel pools, right? So if you get a massive quantity of rain, could these pools overflow?
I'm not sure I would worry about the pools, you know, flooding because of rain. I mean, what you've got a problem with the pools is that the backup power systems and cooling system for the fuel pools are even less robust than for the reactors. And so if you were to end up in a situation where, you know, like at Fukushima Daiichi, you know, power was chronically, you know, critically knocked out to the site for extended periods of time, and cooling systems were unavailable, then the pools could start to heat up. And that's, in fact, what happened at Unit 4 at Fukushima. That's why the U.S. government ended up issuing an advisory to Americans in Japan that they should evacuate from within 50 miles of Fukushima, was because they were concerned about the Unit 4 fuel pool at Fukushima overheating and catching fire.
And there were guys at the Fukushima plant workers who were running out to pull batteries out of trucks and cars. I think what we'll have to do if the storm really, you know, threatens the power source at these reactors is that Elon Musk will have to send in a whole bunch of solar panels to keep power going into the nuke. That would be poetic,
well,
wouldn't it?
That would be ironic, wouldn't it?
Well, but it could happen. You know, I mean, how else are you going to have power at these prices? If the backup power generator, if you have big enough storm surge to knock out the backup power generators, how are they going to get power if the grid goes down?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's a good question. I actually don't. I mean, that would be a good one for the NRC. Is how much power do they need to keep these things going, and could you supply it with solar panels that you could rapidly install there?
I think we ought to. We got to watch that really close. Well, Tim,
yeah, I mean, the thing I would say about this, Harvey, is because, you know, I mean, the thing that I think should be of concern to people, and we should all keep in perspective, is that we're having this conversation more and more frequently. I mean, you know, there was this, you know, it was around this time last year that we had, you know, I mean, within the fall of late summer and fall of 2017, we had this conversation twice about hurricanes that were hitting Texas and South Florida, that were almost direct hits on nuclear power plants, you know, in those two states as well. And here we are in 2018, and hurricane season is just beginning, and we're having this conversation about almost a dozen reactors in the Carolinas. You know, the reality is that, you know, as climate change gains steam and global warming causes more and more severe storms like this to happen more and more frequently, you know, nuclear power is essentially the risks of nuclear power are increasing. And when we talk about, you know, the need to prepare for, you know, communities to be more resilient against extreme weather, against global warming, you know, part of that also has to be an evaluation of the risks, the growing risks that nuclear power exposes us to in these very same situations.
All right, Tim Jensen, the Nuclear Information Resource Service, keep us posted on this. Everybody needs to be watching these nuclear plants as this latest hurricane comes in. Of course, we are the other three guests and me, we're all in California, petrified of what's going to happen at Diablo Canyon. And I know that NIRS is involved with that as well. Let's see who we got with us. Linda Seeley, are you with us? No, I guess not. Donna Gilmore? Hello,
yes,
Donna?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
And,
can you hear me?
Paul Kangas, are you with us? Paul Kangas? No. All right. So we're it's you and me, Donna, and Tim. Tim, I know I do want you to listen in. I know you've got to go, but Donna Gilmore, you're down in the San Diego area. You're a bit north of San Diego, near the San Onofre nuclear plant. We have just had an incident at San Onofre that we only learned about from a whistleblower. Can you want to talk about that with us?
Yeah. So at the last public meeting they had in August, Edison had stopped loading, and they told us it was because they were giving the employees a break. And then at the same meeting, a whistleblower got up, an industrial safety worker that was hired by the vendor's subcontractor doing the loading, Holtec. He said they almost dropped a bare canister filled with nuclear fuel waste 18 feet down in a hole.
Oh, God. All right, so let's talk about this. Almost dropped. What does almost dropped mean?
Well, okay, they are using a kind of a semi-buried system. They have a new kind of a new experimental system at San Onofre, Holtec system. They are putting the waste halfway underground in these holes, the concrete holes lined in steel, and then they have these canisters that are about as tall as a giraffe, about 6 feet wide. They're each close to 50 tons. And they're loading the fuel in the canisters, and then they take them in this heavy transport cast. The canisters are only 5/8 inches thick, so they do not protect the workers from radiation. A lot of radiation goes right through the wall, so they have to put them in this thick transfer cast, they call it, to just get the canister, after it's loaded with fuel, from the pool over to these holes. And they set the transfer cask with the canister in it above the hole, and then they have a way to take the bottom out of the transfer cask. And then they're working blind, try and get this 50-ton canister straight down in this hole that's about 20 feet or so. And in the middle of the hole, I didn't know it, about 4 feet down in the hole, there is this guide ring. It's called an MPC guide. MPC stands for multipurpose canister. There's this guide ring that sticks out in the hole, protrudes into the hole, metal. And so, and they can't look at the canister. There's no cameras. They have no way to get to see the canister that they're trying to put through this guide ring, and there's only about, there's a little over half inch clearance all around this ring. So it's trial and error. They just try and get it down. If it hits on the ring, then they try again. If it scrapes the ring, you know, I mean, it's just a joke. And they caught, it got caught a half, about a quarter, half inch on the edge of this ring, and the loading equipment that was holding the canister, so it lowers slowly, I'm thinking of the word right now, but the thing that was holding the canister up, the cables, it actually went all the way to the bottom of the hole without the canister. So the canister was just hanging on about a quarter inch, quarter half inch of this guide ring, this relatively thin guide ring. And the workers didn't know it. They didn't know. And the only way they can tell if the canister went in the hole is that the amount of radiation coming out of that, the transfer cast sitting above the hole, the only way they know if the canister went down in the hole is the radiation level coming off of the side of that transfer cast has dropped down. And finally, somebody with a radiation detector went over there and said, hey, wait a minute, the radiations are too high coming through the wall of this transfer cast. And that's when they discovered that the canister hadn't gone all the way down in the hole. So, the NRC, their comment was, well, we didn't consider this condition would ever happen. It wasn't analyzed. And then Pomizzano saying, oh, well, you know, yeah, it was a bad day. We almost had a near miss here with a canister dropping 18 feet. But that's okay, because these canisters, they're designed to fall even more than that. Well, I did my homework after I heard that, because it's beyond belief that could be true. And I found a whole technical document that said, if you drop a canister more than 11 inches, and that's while it's being held with this transfer cast, you have to open it up and inspect inside and make sure everything's okay. So the cover-up is unbelievable here. And the NRC came to town, Region 4, to do an inspection, and so we're supposed to get the results of that inspection, which I don't expect too much from the NRC, but and apparently this wasn't the first time this had happened. It happened once before, but you know, nobody told us, and apparently nobody told the workers. Now these workers, they all work for Holtec. The Holtec designed the system, and they were also hired to load the canisters and put them in these holes. And the whistleblower said that they are not safety conscious. They've got trainees in there. Some of the trainees know more than the supervisors. They're understaffed. It's a poor engineering design, obviously. That's the mess we're in right now. We don't have all the pieces. The community wants them to stop loading. This is a ridiculous system. And the canisters, and the fuel inside, I mean, these rods could become damaged. You know, we're talking roughly a Chernobyl disaster in just one can. So this is not a minor event here.
God, it's terrifying. Tim Edneers, have you heard of an incident like this before?
There have been other incidences where, you know, there's been problems with moving casks with cranes, for sure. In fact, there was an incident at both the Palisades reactor in Michigan and the Vermont Yankee reactor in Vermont, where they were, moving a dry cask over the fuel pool, and the crane malfunctioned. And, you know, and in the case of Palisades, it was dangling there for several hours before they were able to fix it. There's really serious potential for incidents with moving casks around.
What makes it worse, Harvey, is they have no backup plan. If that had fallen, if the can became damaged, they have no plan. They've loaded these canisters so hot, they're roughly 200 to 300 degrees Celsius. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. They cannot put the fuel back into the pool that it came out of. You'd have this steam splashing, get an explosion. So they don't even have a plan if something goes wrong. And the NRC's just been looking the other way. We cannot count on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to protect our safety. They are not doing their job. And we have an incompetent vendor and an incompetent utility company right here in California. And so far, no one's really stopping this craziness.
All right, so let's ask you a question here, Donna Gilmore. And thanks, Tim, for staying on. Happy to have you as long as you want. If you need to go, let me know. But, Donna, what would have happened? Well, first of all, I want to point out that we would never have known about this if this whistleblower had not come forward at a public meeting and jeopardized his health and his job by pointing this out. Is that true?
Yes, that's definitely true. Yes, we were told that the employees were working so hard they gave them a break. That's what we were told, an hour or so earlier.
So this guy comes up in a public meeting. Do you know his name offhand? I mean, I heard this.
Yeah, it's David Fritsch. David Fritsch. I have his a video of his statement on San Onofre Safety right at the homepage, sanonofresafety.org, and I have a written transcript of his statement. And he said that the only reason he was only going to come forward if Edison didn't, because the public has a right to know. And he had promised his daughter that he would speak up, and he realizes he's risking his job because, you know, normally whistleblowers speak up and there's consequences. He was very brave to do that, and I don't know where he is right now or what's happened to him. But I don't know for sure what would happen. I don't know for sure if the fuel will go critical. I don't know if we would have an explosion because they're using, because they're burning the fuel too long in the reactors now. They've doubled the amount of time that they're burning the fuel in the reactor, which makes more money, but it causes the rods to degrade. And build up these hydrides that could result in explosions when exposed to air. So I don't know if this drop would have breached the canister or exactly what would happen.
Well, if the thing had dropped into the hole, I don't want to live here.
That's happening.
If this thing had dropped into the hole, let's have this. Let's have this visual scenario. You've got a hole, I assume it's square, into the ground.
No, it's round. It's a round hole.
Oh, it's a round hole.
They tried to put a round peg in a round hole and missed it. Okay? So,
and how wide across is this hole?
Well, what's important is the clearance. It had to get past this metal ring, guide ring, that's 4 feet down inside the canister. So it only had about, Tom Pomazzano, Edison, chief nuclear operator, he said that it was a 9/16 of an inch clearance is all they had to get it in. That's the amount of clearance. And they're working blind. I mean, if you took your finger and made like an okay symbol with your two fingers, and you try and take your finger from your other hand and put it down through that hole, you're going to hit your other fingers. I mean, it's just so simple and basic. And these guys are working blind. And they have to try a few times just to get it in the hole. And I asked Tom Palmisano, I said, well, wait a minute. If they could be off a half an inch, then that means they could be scratching the sides of that canister. So even though this one didn't fall in the hole, all of them, it's trial and error getting it in there, and that's going to scrape the sides of that canister, and that will actually start the cracking process in stainless steel. Stainless steel is only stainless because of a very thin oxide layer that forms, this chromium oxide. And if you break through that with scratches or corrosive materials, you basically have initiated cracking, and the nuclear regulatory system says once a crack starts, it can grow through the wall on its own within 16 years. So this looks like it's a crack initiation system rather than a loading system.
Go ahead.
So you're saying, it's stuck on this rim about 4 inches down in the hole. And if that had dropped without the thing that was holding it up, there's somebody that's going to be making a presentation on this on Sunday. There's an event Sunday where Tom English, who is a nuclear engineer, he worked in the Carter administration, very high up at the DOE. He's going to be making a presentation with details on exactly what would happen to that canister. So that's kind of the teaser event coming up.
I mean, this is surreal. I mean, this is just beyond. And here we have, we have a canister that is how many feet across and how many feet deep? It's 20 feet deep, right? How big is this canister?
It's about 18 feet tall and about 6 feet around. I forget if it's 5 or 6 feet wide in diameter. But it's, think of it the height of a tall giraffe. That's how tall they are.
God.
I'll give you an idea of height. And then, you're talking dropping 50 tons from 18 feet.
50
and the,
tons.
18 feet. And then the size of the canister is 5/8 inch thick, about the thickness of a Mac air book. And in the bottom is, where's the bottom? The bottom is a little thicker. Bottom, let's see, MPC lower. It's about 4.5. The base plate is 3 inches thick, the bottom. So that's
a good one. So
and it's super, really hot, and highly radioactive.
20 feet deep.
It's under pressure, too. It's filled with helium, so nothing explodes. so it's a pressure vessel. A lot of people don't know that. So I think it's only supposed to hold about 45 PSIs. I think it's rated for up to 100. And if the fuel pellets, if the cladding allows the fuel pellets to get out, then the temperature is going to go up inside the canister. I mean, you have the issues of just with your pure physics, and then you have the nuclear and chemical reactions that can happen on top of that. So we haven't totally got all the pieces clear on that. But when the NRC is saying anything more than 11 inches of a fall, you have to open it up, and they have no way to do that. That lets you know how bad a shape we're in with our and what kind of regulation that the NRC is allowing. Other countries have much better systems, but their initial cost is higher, and that's what's been running the U.S. decision making when it comes to nuclear waste and probably nuclear
Judson,
power too.
Tim Judson, are you still with us?
I am.
Oh, so Tim, we're describing here a hole in the ground that has a, correct me if I'm wrong, 20 feet deep. It has a circular cask, spent fuel cask put in it. the sides are 5/8 of an inch. And then the question now is, with these hurricanes, the hurricane coming in, are there any of these holes in the east, in the reactors in the east, that could get flooded? And what would happen if they got flooded?
No, I mean, in fact, at least as far as I know, that all of the reactor sites in the Northeast or in the East Coast that that have dry cask storage of of nuclear waste are using above ground systems that are essentially the same kind of, most of them are the same kind of a canister that Don is describing. But sitting above ground on a concrete pad with a concrete what they call overpack enveloped around it. I mean, what's happening at San Onofre is they're using a new design of a dry cask made by a company called Holtec that's headquartered in New Jersey. And Holtec, is the largest manufacturer of these cask systems around the country. And they sort of, they've been really good at kind of getting, nuclear corporations to buy their casks, essentially because they've developed ways to pack more and more nuclear waste into each canister, essentially saving, the companies a bit of money in terms of how many casks they got to buy and how many they need to pack the waste into. With these casks that they're using in San Onofre, they're packing so much nuclear waste into each of these casks that, in fact, in order to reduce the amount of radiation exposure that people nearby these things would have, they're actually putting them in these underground or below grade silos that provide greater shielding than they could get with these overpacks that are more common in earlier designs of dry casks. So, what's happening at San Onofre is part of a trend in the industry where, in a drive to cut costs on storing nuclear waste, they've opted to go with bigger and bigger dry casks, and they've now reached a limit with these, with these Holtec casks, these new Holtec casks, that there's so much nuclear waste in each of these things that in order to provide sufficient radiation shielding, they've got to do it by putting them in these below-grade silos.
Well, Tim, they're approving these hotter heat loads and hotter canisters with shorter cooling periods on the above ground systems too. So what you have is the NRC is now, this is fairly recently, the NRC is now allowing fuel that's only 2 or 3 years old, this Hiberna, and packing them in. These same canisters are used above ground and below ground. The NRC is just looking the other way and just approving it, knowing all these problems. So, and all of the above ground canisters, they have a thick concrete and sometimes metal overpack. They're either stored horizontal or vertical. They all have air vents in them, and you won't hear the vendors or the utilities talking about the air vents. Most of the other canisters are a half inch thick. So what makes the below ground one worse is they don't have any drains in the bottom of the hole. So, if there's rain or whatever type of climate, the water just sits in the bottom of that hole. So it's actually worse in that respect. But because of the air vents, the radiation is coming through the lids. We just measure, speaking of that, one of our activists, Gene Stone, managed to convince Southern California Edison to let him measure the radiation levels coming out of these air vents on the canisters. The canisters that are used in most of the world, they don't have air vents. They're thick. They're 10 to almost 20 inches thick, and they don't need air vents. They can block all the radiation, but these thin canisters can't. So they measure the radiation levels coming out, and the lids, even though the Holtec canister is below ground, the sealed canister is open to the top with a lid that has huge air vents, and there was up to 600 counts per minute coming out of these newly loaded air vents of the radiation. We don't know what type of radiation is, but that's what's coming out. The older Areva systems we have that are above ground system, kind of like Tim was talking about, above ground systems, we have canisters that are already 15 years old that can corrode from salt air and other things. And they measured the radiation levels of those. Some of the canisters had 2,000 counts per minute, where the Holtec maximum was 600 at the outlet air vent. We didn't even get the inlet air, but the outlet air vent measurements of these vents in the older Areva system, but 2,000 counts per minute, which would correlate to 6 microsieverts if this was like cesium-137. But we're trying to get the NRC, and I'm trying to get the California Department of Public Health radiological unit to come out and do more extensive research and see what these are. You know, when I talk to them, they're busy right now because Nancy Pelosi's concerned about Hunter's Point. So they are now at Hunter's Point looking to see how much radiation is there while they're building houses on Hunter's Point. But so anyway, other than that.
You know, you could not make this up. The question then becomes, and Paul Kangas, you're with us? Paul Kangas? I thought Paul Kangas was with us. Linda Seeley, are you with us? Okay, so the question then becomes, what happens with the heat? I mean, if you've got this, first of all, tell us, Tim and Donna, exactly what is in these casks. How much radiation are we talking about?
Well, there's million. I mean, you know, it's hard to explain, you know, just sort of in lay terms, you know, how much radioactive content we're talking about. But, you know, a typical Holtec cask, you know, has, you know, a comparable amount of long-lived radioactivity, like, you know, isotopes like cesium-137, which are really potent, you know, in terms of environmental contamination. You know, one of these canisters has as much cesium-137 in it as was released into the environment by the Chernobyl meltdown. I mean, so we're talking about, you know, a really large amount of radioactive material in each of these canisters. And, you know, when you're talking about there being, you know, at especially at closed reactor sites like San Onofre, you know, there being, you know, dozens of these casks sitting there.
Harvey, I need to mention one thing. Edison, and I found this out, they didn't want me to know, but I have enough contacts with what's going on at the NRC, that they have asked their vendor, Areva, to get the NRC to allow them to quit reporting radiation levels coming out of these air vents.
God. What's their excuse?
And Calvert...
What's their rationale?
Calvert Cliffs in Maryland. So I did some more digging after I found that. I have the actual documents, and I confirmed this with Edison that they are actually doing this, but he couldn't give me a reason why. And I did more research, and I found Calvert Cliffs in Maryland, their canisters are already 25 years old, so they're overdue in terms of probability for having leaks. They already have that approval from the NRC. They no longer have to report the radiation levels coming out of the air vents. So it seems to me that their only plan is just to hide the leaks from the public. And yesterday I was on two meetings with the NRC on Holtec stuff, and I asked the NRC, I said, what is the limit of amount of radiation that can come out of one of these? What do you approve as your limit? How much radioactivity is allowed to come out of these canisters when they're like new and in pristine condition? I didn't get a straight answer. They don't seem to have a limit for canisters. They just say, each employee can only get so much in a year. You know, that's the kind of answer you get. So I think this is a huge scandal that needs to be really outed, and we need to be able to have public monitoring of what's going on. We need to know the reports of the levels and what's going on. That seems to have been hidden. I don't know, Tim, if you have any awareness of what any radiation levels are coming out of these canisters. Have you heard of anybody even knowing what they're getting?
I don't think there's any direct monitoring that goes on of, you know, sort of what the you know, what the radiation at the vents of the casks are. I mean, they do have to do monitoring of the kind of ambient gamma radiation that emits from, you know, from casks, you know, basically because workers, the exposure to workers at the nuclear site needs to be managed.
But I was told that the radiation monitors that are operating during dry casting facilities, because of the nature of the material.
Well, here's the question then. How hot do these things get? I mean, is there, you know, if you've got all this spent fuel in a cask that just is dependent on a stream of air to keep it cool, at what point does the accumulated heat in one of these casks become a threat to start a chain reaction or to do something really explosive with this spent fuel?
I mean, Harvey, I think that, you know, to kind of put things, you know, in the proper perspective, you know, the anti-nuclear movement has, you know, for some time now advocated that we need to have some form of, you know, of secure, safe, robust, you know, dry cast storage in place, you know, around the country, because, you know, the alternative that's, you know, that is, you know, really what's, you know, sort of, you know, not being dealt with is that, you know, that the fuel pools at reactor sites are packed to maximum density. And in a fire in a fuel pool would be an accident of, you know, really, you know, catastrophic, I mean, you know, beyond conception of what happened at Fukushima and Chernobyl. And so, you know, there has to be a solution to protect reactor communities and to deal with, you know, the incredibly dangerous situation at reactor sites that involves what we've advocated for, which is hardened on-site storage of nuclear waste in, you know, a robust and secure form of dry cast storage. Now, that is not what's happening with the current dry cast storage that's being used around the country right now. And, you know, and what I was talking about before in terms of, you know, essentially what's the industry trend in terms of how nuclear waste is being managed at reactor sites is to either have it in a highly densely packed fuel pool, which is inherently dangerous, or to have it in, you know, sort of essentially, you know, cut rate dry cast designs that is what the industry is preferring to use instead of, you know, to actually sort of, you know, have a nuclear waste practice that's protective of the public health and safety. And that's really what's been missing from the conversation ever since these issues really became kind of front and center after the September 11th terrorist attacks. And, you know, and what the industry has advocated for, what actually the National Academies of Sciences pointed out was necessary, was to deal with the dangers of nuclear waste at reactor sites because of the use of, you know, of high-density storage and fuel pools. And the NRC, in typical fashion, has completely scuttled this issue and pretended like there's no danger to nuclear waste whatsoever. And that's how we end up in this situation, and that's what needs to change.
Yeah, one of the things that that wasn't really an issue, say 20 or so years ago, is the fuel didn't have the high burn up which causes the explosion risk, and so that wasn't addressed. And a lot of the documents that are out there that were used as justification as what will happen, did not consider the explosion risks that are created by the damage that the high burn-up does to the fuel rods, the uranium pellets, and even the uranium basket. ARCS stand for? Technical Oversight Group for the NRC, said on the pool, since high burn-up's been out, he critiqued the NRC and said when the NRC was evaluating the risk of a pool, they assumed that the pool would only have problems at really high temperatures. And he said because of the high burn-up fuel creating all these metal hydrides, uranium hydrides, zirconium hydrides, even aluminum hydrides, you will have an explosion when air hits that at any temperature. So the pool dangers are even worse than people thought before. And those same dangers apply to the fuel in the dry storage. So, and so what is the NRC doing now? What is the industry doing now? They've come up with this new fuel called accident-tolerant fuel, which is code for word for let's double the burn-up levels. And they are ignoring, the NRC and the nuclear industry is ignoring the operating data. There's over 4,000 rods that came out of commercial reactors from around the world that were inspected for damage. And the NRC and the industry is ignoring that data and pretending like high burnup is okay. That is what's going on in this country. And our elected officials, the well-meaning elected officials, don't even know the truth. They don't even know the truth about what's going on.
This is unbelievable.
So that's a problem that we're going to have to solve. There's nobody
we're
else
talking with
doing
Tim Judson and Tim Judson and Donna Gilmore. Tim, how do people get a hold of you?
They can reach us through our website at www.nirs.org, or you can reach us by phone or email at 270-6477, or at nirs@nirs.org.
Give that phone number again.
301-270-6477.
And Donna Gilmore, how do people get a hold of you?
Donna Gilmore. Website is sanonofreesafety.org, SANONOFRE, and then the word safety.org. And I've got an easy email, donnagilmore@gmail.com.
Okay, so let's shift over now. We only got 20 minutes left. I'm not sure what has happened with Linda Seeley and Paul Kangas. Tim, I appreciate your sticking with us. But I do want to get to Diablo Canyon. We're facing a major turning point here at Diablo Canyon. In February of 2019, this coming February, Unit 1 will go down for refueling. Now, apparently, inserted in the reactor cores at the Diablo reactors are something called coupons or some kind of wafer where they can do a test of the embrittlement of the reactor cores. Now, many years ago, Unit 1 at San Luis Obispo at Diablo Canyon was rated as the third most embrittled reactor in the country. Number one, I think, being Oyster Creek, which is about to shut within the next few days. And I think Palisades was second, as I recall. But Diablo Canyon should be somewhere near or over the limit, if there is a limit, for how embrittle the reactor core can be and continue to operate. Now, the World Business Academy has gone to the California Supreme Court asking the PG&E, the owner of Diablo, be forced to do the test on the embrittlement, and they lost. And so we have, at this point in time, no legal standing to force PG&E to do this test on the reactor core. So we're going to have to go political. We're going to have to start a movement, some kind of movement, certainly with state officials, and force the test of the embrittlement of the Diablo reactor. Donna Gilmore, as a Californian, what do you think we need to do here?
Well, you know, I met with the governor's office in a few years, and I had researched where our points of power were, and we actually legally, with the water, the once-through cooling, the way Diablo actually cools water is really illegal now. And the state has the authority to shut Diablo down this instant if they wanted to, because it's out of compliance with that law. And I got him to admit it, but he said because of climate change, they were reluctant to do that. There is a legal way that they could do it, but I'm having trouble seeing how we would convince Jerry Brown to do what he legally could do. That's the quandary.
Tim Jensen, I know you're not a Californian, but how does it strike you that we can proceed and force this test to happen?
Well, I'm a Californian by birth, Harvey. I grew up next to San Onofre, so I'll take exception with that for just a moment.
So that's why you're going.
But you know, I mean, this is the industry's been playing this game across the country. They did the same thing at Indian Point, the nuclear power plant near New York City, a couple of years ago. You know, asking NRC to postpone and you know an inspection interval to test one of these coupons, essentially claiming that, you know, this was the last coupon they had, you know, in the reactor vessel, and so they wouldn't be able to do any further inspections if they did this one. I mean, you know, it's a crazy logic, essentially to avoid having to do a test that could show that the reactor isn't safe anymore. You know, I think you want to know whether, you know, what, you know, how embrittled the reactor is now, and figure out another way to keep it, you know, to test it again later if, in fact, you know, you're able to continue running it. But, you know, this is, you know, I mean, this is a game of hide the ball that the industry is constantly playing as these reactors age and become more embrittled, is to act like, you know, doing the inspection 5 years from now is more important than doing it today.
God, this is, well, is there an actual number? Is there a standard of embrittlement that if we pull this coupon out of the reactor, and it, apparently I've been told it would only cost $200,000 to do this test, which is chicken feed when it comes to these reactors. Is there a number?
The cost of the test isn't the issue for them. I mean, it's, you know, it's the cost of what the results are that, you know, that they're trying to avoid. And you know, it's like if you've been smoking for 60 years, and your pulmonologist wants you to go get a CT scan to see if you've got lung cancer, and you don't want to know the answer, so you decide to postpone it for 5 years. I mean, you know, it's this is the kind of logic that we're talking about. Is really an enforced form of denial that's going on, and The problem is that with a captive agency in the NRC that, you know, that is willing to basically lower its safety standards repeatedly in order to do the industry a favor.
Well, if we get them successfully to pull this coupon out, and if there is a public revelation of how embrittled the core is, and if the core, is there a threshold, a number of embrittlement beyond which they are illegal to operate?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what the NRC does is when they have an issue like this, it's not just a question of what the level of embrittlement is. They also do an analysis to see how likely it is that, you know, that an accident scenario would happen and that would result in, you know, in the embrittlement being a problem. And so what they do is what the NRC does, you know, regularly at this point, is bury the actual risk of the safety issue in what they call a probabilistic risk assessment, in which they factor in, you know, probabilities of different events occurring and bury the essentially bury the safety analysis in statistics that are relevant to, you know, to the safety of the reactor. I mean, they basically use numbers to hide problems and to justify not taking action.
That's the new game at the NRC, is to just, claim everything's low probability so they approve it anyway. That's just one of the ways that they use to continue to approve unsafe technology and aging problems.
I mean, the NRC is basically any particular safety issue should not have a likelihood of leading to an accident that's more than 1 in 100,000. And so what happens is they might have a safety issue with this reactor vessel where, you know, it might indicate that there's a 1 in 10,000 chance of an accident. But when they plug it into their system and find that, well, the chances of such an event occurring are 1 in 20 million, then it bumps the likelihood of the safety problem into a realm where they don't have to deal with it. That's what's going on at NRC on a generalized basis.
Donna Gilmore, you want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, they do that on everything. They do that on the waste. They do that on everything. Now, when we had Gregory Yasko as our chairman, he was trying to do the right thing after Fukushima. He wanted them to learn lessons from Fukushima, didn't want new reactors built till they learned the lessons of Fukushima. And so, you know, Obama tried to get good people on there, but the Senate wouldn't confirm them. So, you know, we've got an election coming up, and people better make sure that they're putting, they're voting for candidates at the, you know, that are going to do the right thing. And we need to have more commissioners on the NRC that are there for safety. What happened to Yasko is they basically drummed him out because he was, you know, doing a concerned about safety. But Obama could never get a majority on that that those commissioners. So we need a good Senate. So it's really important that people vote and support for candidates that are going to care more about safety than nuclear industry profits.
Well, that's from your mouth to God's ear, as they say. Real quickly, Tim and Donna, do you think it's worth mounting a campaign to try and get these coupons tested at the next refueling at Diablo? Tim, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the struggle is that, you know, that it's hard to get leverage on the NRC to make them do something. I mean, the NRC has proved to be a pretty impenetrable agency, and unless you've got essentially, you know, a big war chest for a lawsuit, it's hard to force them to, you know, to act. I think, you know, certainly placing pressure on the state government and seeing what can be done in terms of pulling the power or the purse, you know, on PG&E, you know, to get the, you know, to get them to do this test would be worthwhile.
Donna, what do you think?
Well, if somebody can get Governor Brown to do that, that would be great. I haven't found that person.
Well, it'll be Governor Newsom soon. Maybe we can get to Gavin Newsom in the interim. You guys have been great. Thank you so much. You know, it's devastating that you can talk about the abstract of nuclear waste, but to talk about a 50-ton three canister less than an inch thick hanging in the air over a round peg with less than, you know, with tiny clearance is absolutely insane. Tim, let's hope, and Don, let's hope the storm doesn't drown any of our reactors and that we don't have to look at this reality and have next week's show about the disaster that's engulfing the Southeast. Thank you guys in New York. Thank you, Gary Null and Rich Gale and the crew at PRN. This has been Harvey Sluggo Wasserman at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Maybe next week we'll do comedy. See you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on us.